I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. This week, President Joe Biden hosted a virtual summit to address climate change on a global level. Leaders from 40 different countries were in attendance, and several promised to cut down greenhouse gas emissions in the coming years, including President Biden.
By maintaining those investments and putting these people to work, the United States sets out on the road to cut greenhouse gases in half by the end of this decade.
Organizing the summit is an attempt by Biden to reposition the U.S. as a world leader in the fight against climate change. Under former President Donald Trump, much of that work was halted after his administration chose to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement. Back in March, Biden also announced the creation of an Environmental Justice Advisory Council as part of one of his executive orders to address climate change. With us to help break this all down is Dr. Mustafa Santiago Ali, former senior advisor for environmental justice and community revitalization at the EPA. Dr. Ali, great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're also joined by Maria Lopez Nunez with the Ironbound Community Corporation. She's also a member of the White House's Environmental Justice Advisory Council. Maria, great to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
Mustafa, you quit the EPA just months into the Trump administration. What has been going through your mind with the climate change summit this week?
Well, you know, it is an amazing set of opportunities if it's done right and the accountability is built in, and that we center frontline communities and our most vulnerable countries across the planet, because our people are the ones that get hit first and worst. But seeing some of these commitments is a move in the right direction. We would like to see an even stronger set of numbers to make sure that many of the impacts that are happening inside of Black and Brown and Indigenous communities are lessened and then hopefully eliminated one day. So it's a step in the right direction, and we are optimistic that folks will continue to strengthen the various commitments that they've made.
Maria, you're a member of the White House Environmental Justice Council. What exactly is the council working on?
We're working on, you know, the initiative called Justice 40. And Justice 40 is supposed to be a 40% carve out of the investments. We're talking about the climate related investments, making sure that they go to frontline communities. And I hope that everyone understands that 40 should be considered the floor and not the ceiling. You know, it's the starting point. To guarantee that investments are directed to those who have been most directly impacted.
So then, Mustafa, back to you. What are your thoughts on the Biden administration's actions on climate change to date, specifically when it comes to environmental justice?
Well, you know, it's great to have an administration that actually centers both science, climate, and environmental justice. So I think that many of us who've been doing this work for a long time are pleased that that's happening. And we want to make sure that folks also understand that you can't win on climate change if you don't win on environmental justice. You know, Maria just shared, you know, about the 40%. That's a step in the right direction. But we got to make sure that those are real, because it's labeled as benefits. And what our community needs is dollars also. So we want to make sure that folks are actually receiving the benefits and the dollars that are necessary for them to continue to frame out the direction that they want to go in. Also seeing that he has begun to place inside of some of the federal agencies folks who have either come from sets of environmental justice work or competencies in that space is also a step in the right direction. But that needs to continue to grow, because there are over 17 federal agencies and departments that have a distinct responsibility for environmental justice. And of course, under the Biden administration, he has said that it is an all of government approach. So that means that each one of those agencies and departments should be laser focused on the dynamics that are going on inside of our community. And those dynamics, those impacts that are happening in Black and Brown and Indigenous communities and Asian and Pacific Islander and sometimes lower wealth white communities that are actually making our lives shorter and making us sick are also the drivers in warming up our oceans and our planet. I'm pleased that they're moving in the right direction, but we know that if we don't stay continually holding people accountable, then sometimes folks will slip.
Mustafa, I want to talk a bit about this week's climate summit. Did any specific announcements from the Biden administration stand out to you?
Well, I think they were all significant, because we got a chance to see where some of the 40 members from 40 different countries actually sat in relationship to their commitments. So, you know, many of us had hoped that at least 50% number would come out from the Biden administration or from the United States, and it's 50 to 52%. Some would like to see that number higher because we understand, you know, the climate crisis that we find. I was pleased to a degree to hear that Japan, you know, was giving somewhat successful and significant numbers. And what I mean by that is that, you know, anybody below 50% is falling short. So Japan came in at about 46% by 2030. So for the listeners, what that means is, you know, they're going to make sure that they're cutting emissions by that number and then being net zero by 2050, which is sort of the baseline for folks now across the planet. Canada fell a little bit short, to be quite honest with you, even though some would say, you know, of course, the United States and China are the two major contributors. Everybody is contributing to some degree to what's going on, or at least the major countries, if you want to label them that way. So Canada came in somewhere between 40 to 45% by 2030. China was a little interesting, and I'll just close out with China. You know, China said that their peak emissions before 2030 will be carbon, you know, that they'll do some work in that space, didn't give a hard number, but said that they would be carbon neutral by 2060, which is outside of that norm number of 2050 right now.
Maria, I want to go back to what you said before, which is the Biden administration has pledged that 40% of the benefits of all its climate policies will be directed towards disadvantaged communities. Can you break that down for us? Because what exactly do we mean by benefits? And then how does this, what does this mean on a practical level?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, like Mustafa was saying, we need 40% of investments, not just benefits, because benefits could be anything. It could be the bike lane. It could be, you know, if there's a park that gets planted over there, maybe has an effect on our communities. So right now, you know, the council is working on the definition of the 40% of what is the benefit. But I think we need to go still many more steps further, right? Because I think right now at the summit, the United States is talking to other governments, and the United States government really should be talking to environmental justice communities and centering this conversation about what we're going to do about climate change with our own people. You know, we can't just have state-to-state relationships. We need to reconnect and rebuild the relationship that's been broken between the federal government and the communities who are directly impacted.
And Maria, how much can the White House actually do on environmental justice without legislative action?
I mean, there's always plenty we could do. For instance, I'm not too happy about the net zero. I would like to see us talk about direct emissions, cutting emissions at source, you know, because right now our communities are being assaulted by carbon sequestration plans, techno fixes, geoengineering. There are things that we need at the community level. And I think that we could start the conversation, because that would force legislative action. You know, if there was a big take the show on the road, talk to all the different communities across the country, environmental justice community, indigenous communities, then I think that that would go really far in building the political will to get something done. And of course, things could be done by executive action, right? We need executive orders right now. Trump wasn't shy to use them, and I would love to see more forcefulness on behalf of justice for our communities.
Mustafa, what were some of the biggest bureaucratic holdups that you witnessed inside of the EPA on environmental justice?
Well, you know, if we're going to have an honest conversation, something I always call real talk, you've got biases, discrimination, and systemic racism that has been built into our policies for decades that make it more difficult for communities of color to actually get justice. So the unpacking and dismantling of that is critically important. And then even if you saw, you know, strong work being done or attempted on the federal level, we still have to realize that those dollars and those actions leave the feds and go down to the states and the counties and local governments. So as it's making that journey, you have the assumption that folks are going to do the right things on those levels. And then sometimes yes, and sometimes no. So you have to make sure that one, you're building stronger accountability into the process. And two, that those folks have the resources and tools that they need. And then the other part, which was outside of the government, but is definitely connected to the government, is making sure that frontline organizations have the resources that they need to build the capacity to be able to navigate all the challenges that exist when in dealing with bureaucracies and trying to make real change happen. So this administration has the exact same set of challenges, and then also the overlay of the climate crises that we're fighting. So we've got a lot of work to do to make sure that folks have those competencies, that there's accountability, and that both folks on the local level in government and in frontline organizations have the resources they need to be able to make change happen.
Maria, your organization is based in Newark, New Jersey. What impact does environmental racism have on residents of Newark specifically?
I mean, when we look at the skyline, we see the state's largest garbage incinerator, right? Which 50% of the trash is not even, it's coming from New York City. You know, it's not trash that's being generated even within our own state. Then we have two power plants in our neighborhood. We're right next to the Port of Newark and Elizabeth. You know, we have fat rendering plants, plastic plants. We're also bordered by the longest Superfund site in the country. That's the Passaic River, where we made Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. And the poison that was left behind of that, it's all over our neighborhood. And so much of it has never been cleaned up. You know, we have over 100 brownfield sites. And what I want folks to understand is, when I'm talking about my neighborhood, I'm talking about 4 square miles. You know, so I'm talking about a concentration of pollution, legacy pollution that has not been cleaned up for many administrations, you know. So I'm thankful for the movement that's been holding our federal government steadily accountable and for us to be at this moment. But I want to see real change, not just words, you know. I want us to slingshot into the just transition and make sure that we don't leave behind communities like ours.
Mustafa, how does what Maria is describing in Newark compare to the effects of environmental racism on communities of color nationwide?
Let me just call out that Maria and the folks at Ironbound have been doing amazing work for decades, and often with not having the right amount of resources that they needed. You know, the dynamics that we have going on across our country that ground truth and anchor us to why this work, both on the environmental justice side and the climate side, is so important. We have 100,000 people who die prematurely from air pollution every year in our country. Mm-hmm. That's more folks that are dying from air pollution than are dying from gun violence. More people are dying from air pollution than are dying from car crashes. And all those things are important. And we have to give our attention to it to make change happen in that space. In our country, we got over 60 million people who have dealt with unsafe drinking water over the last decade. And we know in both those situations that I mentioned, it is primarily Black and Brown and Indigenous communities that are dealing with it. No community should have to deal with that. Or in Port Arthur, Texas, where Hilton Kelly is a Goldman Prize winner. You know, a once thriving African-American community, they're surrounded by petrochemical facilities, and they have high rates of cancer and liver and kidney disease and a number of other things. So when our communities are impacted, our health is impacted, and then our wealth is impacted because our homes lose value when we're next to these types of things. And historically, we have placed our housing in floodplains and next to toxic facilities. And you see it across our country, whether we're talking about on reservations, or if we're talking about in Appalachia with lower wealth white communities, or of course, Black and Brown communities all across our country. When you look at what's going on in Alaska, where brothers and sisters are literally, their homes are sliding into the ocean because of the changes that are happening from climate change and from the exposures that they've had to deal with from toxic pollution. Or we've seen what happened with brothers and sisters, and my family is from Puerto Rico. You know, the impacts that happened from Hurricane Maria, but it was happening even before Hurricane Maria got there, that folks were dealing with Superfund sites and brownfield sites and the military, you know, doing testing and leaving it behind in places like Vieques and others. So we have a lot of work to do as we're having this conversation about climate. You know, we've got to be very aware that we have to rebuild the infrastructure inside of our communities if we're going to be able to fully be able to participate in this new clean economy that the president and others talk about and as needed. But we've got to make sure that we're not placing veneers over the challenges that still exist inside of our communities.
Maria, do you have any advice for local organizers trying to push back against environmental racism and organize?
I mean, it's I laugh just because the challenge is so hard, because for organizers on the ground, they're not just dealing with climate change. You know, they're dealing with racism, with police brutality, with immigration raids, gentrification. You know, like it is a hard time to be an organizer in community. And one thing that Nancy Zack, who's been at working with us for 47 years, you know, she always says, we can't give up at the same time. You know, so make sure that you have a strong team with you and that you take turns, because this work does wear us down, but we have to keep going. Because of decades of organizing, we've reached the moment we're at today, with environmental justice finally being centered. And I'm hopeful that if we keep pushing, we're actually going to get somewhere this time.
Maria Lopez Nunez works with the Ironbound Community Corporation and is a member of the White House's Environmental Justice Advisory Council. And Dr. Mustafa Santiago Ali is a former senior advisor for environmental justice and community revitalization at the APA. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.